sharing in this, sharing this festival with many of you. Before I get started with the slides and my presentation, I would like to comment briefly on the title, The Unbearable Lightness of Building, because it sounds initially like some smart alecky graduate student's version of a flashy title. And although I do thank one of my graduate students for giving it to me, there is a reason that I used it. In fact, two reasons. One is that I wanted to connect this talk, which is on Baroque architecture, with the other parts of the festival, which have to deal with the more contemporary culture. And since film culture was talked about and rather dominant in terms of the weekend, these double weekends, it seemed appropriate to use that title. Also, I'm doing this in order to emphasize that a work of art or architecture is more than something merely splendid or amazing, that it, in order to carry and convey something of significance, something of the significance of its creation, we have to experience it within its setting. And that setting, the making of it, can be twofold: the setting of origin, which we try to recreate as historians, and the setting in which we now experience something, that is, the present context. And I might illuminate, or try to illuminate, that double setting and that set of references by a brief quotation from the music critic Edward Rothstein, writing on von Karajan's Nazi recordings. And he says this: if music is treated as if it had no grounding in the concrete world of persons and politics, if it is treated as purely a formal construction, music risks becoming a novel without characters, using words without meaning. Education, that is our education about these works of art, becomes focused on execution and analysis. Listening becomes focused on mere pleasure or cultish devotion. This is one reason why so much music has become relatively unimportant today, despite its plentitude. We have filtered out the aspects of music that connect it to creator and culture on any level deeper than, quote, music appreciation. So we hear Mozart's music not as an intricate commentary on the relationship between manners and natural passions so important to his time, but as simply great, magical, sublime, holy. And we listen to Giza King, believing firmly that there is no difference between his Mozart and ours. I'm not going to be able fully or appropriately to convey the present experiencing of 18th century architecture, but I will try to relate to that in some fashion. But I do want to emphasize this connection of the Baroque world to the present at the outset. There is another major reason for using this title. The architecture that we will be looking at, though it is constructed of solid masonry, appears light. That is, its substance is eroded, it is honed away, resulting in buildings that do not seem supportable, as if they cannot be borne on their structure, the unbearable lightness of building. Now, this is not an absolute condition that I'm talking about, but there is a tension between support and supported, as you will see, and it's fundamental to understanding the architecture. Now, in pursuing this theme, I also need to emphasize that it is not intended to characterize all of Czech architecture of the 17th and 18th centuries. But if it is not the significant architectural investigation of that time, then it is one of the most important. Now, I've said I'm pursuing a theme, and in doing that, I am going to be operating very differently than Barbara Retton. And I appreciate the fact that she went first because she established the groundwork in terms of a political, social, and cultural milieu that is very important to understanding the architecture in a number of ways. First of all, the whole matter of the 30 Years' War, and then the intervention of the Habsburgs in these lands. Secondly, in the connection of this part of the world to other areas within Europe, in this case, in terms of architecture, specifically in terms of Italy and, to some extent, Bavaria. I'm also, though, in drawing on the previous speaker and using that setting, I am going to be pursuing material almost as if I had a tunnel vision, rather than the more broad perspective that was provided in the previous hour. Mine is going to be much more focused and, I hope, not too exclusive, but certainly it will be very much directed in terms of this one concern, this one theme. Having said all of these things, let me proceed and look at some of the architecture. If we could have the slides and the lights, please. Oops, I've lost all my light here. Yeah, but it's not doing anything. There must be a switch there that... oh, I see. I probably unplugged myself. Yep, okay. Okay, thank you. Barbara talked extensively about Olomouc, and I think that's where I will begin. If we look at the renewal of building that occurs in the wake of the 30 Years' War, that is from approximately 1650 on, that is after a period of extensive destruction and deprivation in terms of people, building supplies, food to eat, and so on, one finds in this part of the world, as elsewhere in Central Europe, the importation of Italian talent, both designers as well as workforce, in order to construct buildings. And you can see that in the Church of St. Michael's in Olomouc, which was designed by an Italian that worked in this area and elsewhere, Carlo Lorago, and the building itself was put up in the 1670s. If one looks at it from the outside, it seems like a fairly square-shouldered and simple affair, a large boxy bottom to the building with three domes perched on the top. And if one turns to a section and a plan of the interior, that reading from the outside seems confirmed. The box of the building is rather obvious as the external wall. The inside of the building consists of three compartments. Each one is marked by one of those domes, but the interior of the domes to either end, in fact, is rather low. The cap is higher than what one sees below, so that one has the impression of these three structures set within the box, rather straightforward and direct interior, which looks something such as you see it on the screen now. This kind of work was also brought to the capital, to Prague. For example, we can look at the church of the Crusaders' Church, St. Francis in Prague, right at the end of the Charles Bridge, which was done by a architect with a French name, Jean-Baptiste Matte, but he was, and in fact he was a Frenchman born in Dijon, but he had trained in Rome as a painter with Poussin, and then he came to Prague in the 1660s and practiced architecture. And his St. Francis, in fact, reflects very much an Italian idiom in terms of format. I'll specify that in a minute, done with a certain amount of French coolness and rational vigor. The exterior, as you can see, is the entryway, is the facade is on the lower right of the slide. The building is dominated by a dome perched on a drum. The plan has this centralized character to it, with the dome over the central area, entry down there, small chapels in the corners, and then the choir blows out the back slightly. And if one goes inside, you see something of the wall-like character, the mural character, the clarity, and also something of the plainness of the interior. It's only if we look up into the dome with the distorting eye of the camera that you begin to see something of a more animated architecture in terms of the pendentives in the dome, the arches, an architecture of curves and movement suggested by the photographic image. Now, it is that animation which comes into full force in the early 18th century and which establishes the point of departure for our investigation. Let me set this up briefly by noting that what we are going to observe is an architecture that has a revolutionary character to it. It's an architecture promoted by a family of architects who had come to Prague from Bavaria by the name of Dietzenhofer, and it is an architecture in which the emphasis is on the space in the building rather than the mass, that is the solid part. And to understand these buildings, we have to see space as the primary ingredient, that is the continuity of a spatial figure inside the building rather than in terms of the solid mass of the structure. Indeed, I use this word mass, it has a resonance here because this architectural investigation is pursued on the basis of ecclesiastical architecture in the first instance. And although I will turn to secular architecture some, the revolution takes place in terms of the church rather than in terms of the palace, the town hall, or other secular buildings. Let me begin with this building on the screen by the chief architect of this Dietzenhofer clan, a man by the name of Christoph Dietzenhofer, who came to Prague in 1675 and took on citizens' rights in 1686. He came with a bunch of brothers, Georg and Wolfgang and Leonhard and Johann and a sister, and all of the brothers became architects, and some of the sons became architects, so this was a very highly developed dynasty. Now, if we look at this building on the screen, one of the first that we'll see of Christoph Dietzenhofer's. It's for a monastery church in Oberiste, done just after the turn of the century, that is 1702. And the first thing that strikes one upon seeing it from the outside, compared to Olomouc, which we looked at from the outside, and compared to St. Francis, which we looked at from the outside, is that something has happened in terms of the facade. It has, instead of become a straight-walled affair, rather crisp and belted in, instead now it consists of a set of concave parts. It's been set into motion by the sequence of curves which seem to be hollowed out of the substance of the building, or seem to be have elements or sections that project forward like prows of a ship. So there's an activity in the facade which contrasts with what happens at that flank. The plan of the building reveals something of the initial thinking process that Christoph Dietzenhofer is pursuing. You see the church here, the monastery complex is off to the right, the facade that we looked at is here. And if one goes inside, you see that, as with St. Francis, this is a centralized building, but something odd is going on because relative to that structure, because the wall has been set into a series of concave parts, and a vault, the ceiling over the building, has been arranged as a set of parts which seem to create an elaborate pattern out of the vault. And the center of that vault stands in the middle of the building next to these concave sections of wall, but not in relationship to the large bays that are established. So a syncopation between what is with the bay below and the center of the vault above suggests an interaction between elevation and vault, which, when one looks inside, becomes quite dramatic. The elevation, as you can see here, has been animated by this set of curve units, and the vault itself then rises above that, looking very high because of the painting that is on the surface, and I'll look at it in detail in a moment, but in fact not being that tall at all, being rather low relative to the illusion that is created by the fresco on the vault itself. Also note that Dietzenhofer has hollowed away the wall, or at least he's starting to hollow away the wall by making huge windows, both below and above the cornice. The detail of the vault itself, where you can see where these configurations of triangular shapes came from in the plan, and where the central circle of the vault is located with its illusionistic dome painted on it. The next move that Christoph Dietzenhofer makes is with the Church of St. Clair in Hieb, which I must mention is parenthetically is also the birthplace of Balthasar Neumann that George mentioned. And this was a design from 1707, so it's 5 years after the Oberiste church. Now, those arguments that were first posed in the earlier building have taken on a certain, a more elaborate life. The rectangular shell is still there, as we saw before, but the actual wall has been extensively eaten away. As you can see, it now consists of pieces of masonry rather than a continuous surface. And the vault itself has been changed into these two oval units set at cross axis to the main axis of the building, and each one very distinct with spaces between. This is the way Christoph records that interior in a longitudinal section where you can see the elevation and the vaults and then the choir area off to the right. Now, this drawing also is indicative of an approach of Christoph's that is going to be have major consequences. And you can see that if you carefully read the elevation, because what one sees here, and I will use this as an example, is a vertical support which runs up the full height of the building and then props up almost as if it were a pole this vault, which is treated as a surface, almost for our terms like the shell of a reinforced concrete structure. That's not what it is, but just to set up the image. And if you look at the drawing closely, you'll see that he is very consequent in how he pursues that. The edge of the shell is picked out so that it never simply melts into any other part of the architecture. So the suggestion is here of these thin supports supporting a shell that are standing almost on their own in the space, with the actual outside wall a flat, unarticulated surface, a secondary element. And you have then these sail-like units located within the space, constituting the space, the definers of the space. Christoph brings these investigations to a first point of resolution in this monastery church at Brevnov, which is really in the outskirts of Prague. The building, it was put up between 1708 and 1715, so you can see he is moving along at a very rapid clip. I mean, within 6 years, he's put up these buildings and managed to push to a certain point of resolution in terms of what he was working on. Let me first look at the outside, because the outside is a clear indicator of what's going to happen on the interior. This is a detail of the facade that you saw before, and as you can see, that end of the building is quite flat. It has rather flat pilasters, flat wall. The gable is fairly flat relative to the whole. But if you go around the corner of the building, this is the facade we looked at, and look at this side entry. Christoph has done here something unexpected and unusual. That is, he's taken the actual space of the actual surface. Somehow this has gotten all caught up. The actual surface of the building, and cut it open, marked that cut by these columns, and you have the impression as if an interior layer of the building has been exposed by slicing away that outer skin, which was so flat under tension, and that there is an interior substance or something which is about to break forth, as if a membrane had been sliced open and the interior, the guts inside, are ready to spill out. And indeed, the interior is quite a powerful one. Here's the plan of the building. The facade we looked at is down there. The monastery complex is over to this side. If one looks at the plan, just in terms of its major parts, it has a central section, which is matched by two equal units on either side, and then finally the choir at the end of the building as an add-on. These central this central section has a set of forms which we will see actually overlap and intersect with one another, and I will show the detail of the interior shortly, propped up on these very thin supports, which project out into the space. In a sense, the potency of this central section is suggested by the way in which Christoph treats the flanks of it. If you look at the plan, you'll see that this flank is drawn in compared to this one, which seems to spill out. The part that faces into the courtyard as compared to the part which faces out into the open terrain. Now, moving inside the building, looking toward the entranceway, the facade that we saw, the other entryway that we looked at was off here to this side, the interior begins to appear initially like a series of undulating supports that are propping up a vault that itself also undulates. And if we look at that vault, in that support system and vault in detail, we'll see something like this. Here, the supports that project into the space, pitched at an angle, so one faces in at 45 degrees into the space, the other in the opposite direction from that, and almost and articulated like a vertical pole within the interior, almost freestanding within that, not attached to any other kind of solid mass, and supporting a set of arches which lead into that section of vault. This is the choir vault up there, which when we look at it in detail reads like this. And here you see what that intersection of plans were, intersection of lines were that you saw in the plan. The support system has a layer shown here as cream colored with some decoration and representation on it, which is differentiated from another layer shown here as the part of the building that has extensive fresco on it. It's literally lower than this part, or in this case, raised up. And when you begin to see these fields in relationship to one another, you begin to realize there's this elaborate tapestry of a vault which seems as if it is running along the top of the building on top of these parts, which are another layer just below it. So not only has the elevation been pulled apart, but so has the vault system itself. The whole thing has now become this interlocked interior of that consists of both vertical support elements and shell elements in the vault. If one looks in a detail at the bay and the outer wall, you can see this even more vividly. The outer wall with the window is a very smooth curved surface. That unit that's being supported, the vault is up, is on the top of the slide, and you can see how the differentiation is made between the vault and the wall itself with the supports pushing into the space. This investigation was then taken by Christoph directly into the capital, into the city of Prague itself. One of the hallmarks of the city still today is this combination of tower and dome, which you see on the screen now. And what it shows is, what it marks out, is the Church of St. Nicholas on the Malostrana. And whether you're looking at it from inside the town itself or out onto the town from above, as you do here from the Hradčan, those two elements are a very dominant part of the city, that tower and that dome. And this is what they mark: a building that on the outside, St. Nicholas, on the outside has this extraordinarily animated facade. Now you can see those tentative experiments of just a few years earlier have reached quite a culmination. Not only is the facade curved in a number of ways, but elements seem to be detached from that curve to serve as separate units housing large windows, so that the facade is opened up by the windows, by the orders, the columns and the pilasters, the bay units and the curves, into a real tour de force. The building was started in early, in already in 1703, but the final plans, Christoph's final plans for this, actually were done between 1708 and 1710, and then the structure was completed the following year, 1711. So it is a structure that is right in the midst of this experimentation, at least chronologically. And here's what has now happened in terms of the interior. Again, yeah, I think that focuses a little bit. Good. Well, it was almost there. Okay, yeah. It's hard to read these lines. That's good. Thank you. There, as you can see, there's no more continuous wall at all. There's simply these chunks of wall that jut into the space. Entryway is down there, altar down there, chapels between these chunks of wall, and then a vault system which consists of those oval units marked by edges, by oval fields that we saw in the earlier, but now creating now very vividly creating a set of interlocked syncopations with the elevation. If this is a bay, for example, that normally would be read across that way, the vault instead opens out the area between the supports. And where you would normally have the top of the vault in a bay, in fact, you have the coming together of these ribs, as you see here. The support system emphasizes that by being cut into two, so it juts out at an angle so that it can support those ribs. And if we look at Christoph's section for this building, we'd see something like this, where the elevation that we're looking at, the vault system, is rather vividly recorded. This is actually a drawing done probably after the building was constructed, but nevertheless of the time, and gives us a good idea of what it was like. And you can see that vertical freestanding support and how the rib then buckles over the space. What is extraordinary about that is that in order to do this, to make this move, that in fact the edge of the vault or the rib, as the case may be, has to bend three-dimensionally through the space, starting at a vertical and at an angle, and then bending up through the space to wind up at a horizontal before coming down into a similar position opposite its mate on the other side of the nave, which creates an extraordinarily dynamic visual architecture. It looks today something like this, but if you see the interior now, you realize that something strange has happened, because the ribs that I showed you on the drawing are no longer there. In fact, they were done away with when the vault was painted, so that the whole building has this undulating shell at the top, which is extraordinarily unexpected, but nevertheless is part of the making of this building over a longer period of time, several decades in the 18th century. Also, I think looking at this flank in this fashion, you see how much the architecture has been opened up, the importance of the light, and how the curve and counter curve and the syncopation have all contributed to extraordinarily animate the space. If we stand at the entryway of the building and look down toward the altar, you see a large dome that arises in that section of the building. This, in fact, that unit was added on after Christoph's death and after Christoph had finished the building by his son, Kilian Ignaz Dietzenhofer. This was the choir was developed between 1739 and 1752. So you have father and son working on this building. I suppose there's good stuff here for some Freudian analysis, if it must be, because it is the dome of the sun which now is seen visibly throughout Prague, marking the choir, marking this addition to the nave that his father, the facade and the nave that his father had originally built. This, of course, would seem like the obvious point of departure to wrap up Christoph's career and then talk about Kilian Ignaz Dietzenhofer's career. But it also, that large vertical extension that, or extrusion of the choir that you saw, brings up, in fact, a thought of turning to another architect before proceeding with the Dietzenhofers. Talking about this other architect to indicate that it was not only the Dietzenhofers who pursued this investigation of architectural space, but that once it had been initiated, others began and picked it up quite rapidly. The person I want to mention in this regard is a man by the name of Giovanni Santini Eichel, sometimes just called Johann Santini Eichel, and although he has a very Italian name, he is born in Prague. And that is also indicative of this relationship between Italy, the coming north of Italians who then settle in whose second generation then become part of the Czech builders. Let's see, does that focus more sharply there? Yeah, that's good, thanks. If one looks at this one building by Santini Eichel that I'm going to talk about, a church in Gladruby, done in 1712, that is just a few years after, literally 1 year after the completion of the Prague church by Christoph Dietzenhofer, you can see that if you have very sharp eyes and can read the key, that this is a building that's actually a combination work. There was a Gothic or medieval structure which is shown in these, which existed but was destroyed, but of which some of the wall remained, and you can see that in the dark areas. And then Santini Eichel introduced into that fragmented wall the other parts of the building, facade, and all of the choir, and vaulted the building anew. And interestingly, what he did in terms of the vaulting was not to turn to those shells that Christoph Dietzenhofer had pursued, but instead to turn to this kind of ribwork that you see in this photograph in terms of the nave, the west end of the building, moving down toward the east end of it, and most emphatically in the choir itself. An extraordinary performance of very slender supports which go up to create this incredible interlocked set of ribs. What is fascinating about this building and Santini's exploration is that he uses here forms that are reminiscent of another time, the Gothic, the medieval world, precisely one of those periods in which architecture was extensively dematerialized, transformed extensively into space and light, as Christoph Dietzenhofer was doing it, using a different architectural vocabulary. So there is this apparent connection that Santini establishes to that medieval building past, picking up on the theme of this spatial exploration. And he didn't have far to go to see this, the source of this kind of architecture. For example, in Prague itself, the Vladislav Hall was an enormous open space with this elaborate and very effective ribbed vault, which had been put up in the late 1400s, by a Benedict Reed, and offers an example, a way of thinking about an open architecture using that kind of rib structure that Santini Eichel could capitalize on. Now I would like to turn from these two actors, Christoph Dietzenhofer and Santini Eichel, to a third personality, that of Kilian Ignaz Dietzenhofer, and look at his version of a St. Nicholas church in Prague. This, the building that you see on the screen now, not the St. Nicholas that he worked on together with his father, but a St. Nicholas in the old town. This was done in the 1730s, and it stands at the edge of the main square of the town, an edge which in fact had initially been built up more than it is now, so that the building was hidden behind other structures, but had an edge that leaked out into the open center of the medieval city, the center of the old town. As a consequence of that strange condition of being both at the edge of the center and encased in the fabric of the city, Kilian Ignaz Dietzenhofer produced a most unusual, unexpected, but ingenious plan. There is a main facade which is here, which opens to the streets from the town. There is a second facade which is here, which was on a broader street, which then led into the city itself. And there was the apse, which you see on the right of the screen, which in fact was visible from the open square of the town. So he responds to all these different conditions by generating two facades plus a important circular element in terms of the end of the building to be seen from a greater distance, and wraps all of that around a centralized structure in which he now does something like this. He emphasizes that center with an enormous dome which seems to be extruded or pulled up over a set of very slender supports up and up and up and up until it finally culminates in that vertical profile of the dome and a huge lantern. It's as if he'd taken something of that verticality of medieval architecture, the Gothic cathedral, for example, and translated it into a different architectural language using columns and round arches, and managed to meld the two of them into a very effective whole. Let's briefly look at what happens as a result. Here you're standing at an intermediate level in the building, at a runway. It's more than a balcony. It's like a whole sidewalk that wraps around the entire building from the choir all the way around the entryway and back to the other side of the choir at mid-level, so to speak. The floor of the building down below, the huge dome up above. And if you look at the detail here for a moment, that is these piers that are supposedly support that dome, you'll see they've been entirely eaten away. The huge openings on all sides, you literally look right through the pier, and where you would also expect support for the dome up above, you have in fact a panel which has been translated into a painted surface with large, somewhat decorative brackets rather than anything that would seem